Thank you so much, Mitchell, for the kind introduction. And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming out for this APAC evening. I'd like to thank Rabbi Magidovich for hosting us here at Bnei Torah. APAC is a unique organization. It is the gold standard of lobbying groups, has had extraordinary success. And as you just heard, it's a success that is at risk. There are significant forces that want to undo the U.S.-Israel relations. I think they're getting stronger. Therefore, it is necessary, all the more necessary, to become part of the work to sustain and indeed increase the U.S.-Israel relationship. What makes APAC so unusual is that its members are not just giving money, not just giving time, but really getting involved in a specific and personal way with candidates. And I've seen over and over again how that kind of personal rapport with politicians beginning at the local level and ending up at the White House has a significant impact. But my topic this evening is not the U.S.-Israel relationship. Be glad to take it up in the Q&A. My topic, as you heard, is radical Islam and the war on terror. It's a war that's been going on for over 5 years, and yet it is a mystifyingly imprecise war in many ways. Do you feel that it's war? Are we lacking in gasoline or steel or rubber? No. But more specifically, two things I'd like to address. One, who is the enemy in this war? And two, how do we deal with and defeat this enemy? And so that's what I will begin with, and then there'll be time for discussion. Who is the enemy? There are three alternate answers to that. In the first place, what one might call the establishment answer, and then the insurgent answer, and then my answer. The establishment answer is that it's terrorism. War on terror. Colin Powell, one day after 9/11, said 9/11 should not be seen as something done by Arabs or Islamics. It is something that was done by terrorists. Nothing to do with Islam. Terrorism. Terrorism is a problem in itself. Evil people engaging in violent activities. But this is not an adequate description, as I think people have over these last 5.5 years come to realize. In the first place, it's an inaccurate euphemism. It would be like calling World War II, as a result of the attack on Pearl Harbor, a war against surprise attacks. Yeah, there was a surprise attack. It was very important. It killed thousands of people. But that was not the topic of the war. That was not the enemy. It was just a tactic that was used. And indeed, terrorism is a tactic that's used by the enemy. The enemy could use conventional warfare, could use nuclear warfare, could use any other sort of warfare. Secondly, there are terrorists who are not this main enemy, Tamil Tigers, Shining Path, many others. So, terrorism is not what we're dealing with. It's just a manifestation of the problem, not the problem. The insurgent position is that the problem is Islam, Muslims, Islam, the religion of Islam, or the cult of Islam. Muhammad was a pedophile, jihad is a permanent danger, and so forth. And while there is a kernel of truth here, because there is an Islamic element, it is wrong as well. And it's wrong for several reasons. First, it's ahistorical. The problem we face today was not around a few decades ago. When I began my study of Islam in the Middle East in the late 1960s, radical Islam, jihad, beheadings, honor killings, women in burqa, these were not issues. They were not issues in Egypt. They were not issues in Chicago. This is a historical phenomenon. It's something that has changed over time and presumably will continue to change. There's no reason to extrapolate from the present to the past and the future. It would be like looking at Nazi Germany in 1940 and saying everything about Germany led up to this, and you can expect a 1,000-year Reich. No. Not everything led up to it, and no, it was a 12-year Reich. It was a specific moment in time, and one can now see with the benefit of 60 years hindsight that Germany was in a very strange state at that time, and it was a temporary state. And with due differences, the Muslim world is in a strange state. It's not the way it always has been, and need not be the way it always will be. Secondly, if one says that Islam and Muslims are the enemy, then one makes all Muslims into the enemy. And that is a mistake. One needs Muslims. Muslims are friends. There are plenty of Muslims who are our side. I'll get into this a little bit more later, but we need Muslims to come up with an alternative to this radical formulation. Only Muslims can come up with a different kind of Islam. And also, just in the last couple of weeks, there were massive demonstrations in Pakistan and Turkey by moderate Muslims in support of the regime in Pakistan, against the regime in Turkey, standing up for a moderate form of Islam or a secular form of Islam. These are hundreds of thousands of people. They can't just be dismissed. There is a crisis in Turkey right now over whether Turkey is going to go in an Islamic direction or not. And there are powerful institutions, the judiciary, the military, that are against this. These are not insignificant forces. Third, even if one believes that Islam is the enemy, that doesn't leave the U.S. government with much of a policy option. This is not a Christian crusader government that's going to go out and convert Muslims to Christianity. What are you going to do? If Islam is the enemy, where do we stand? So I would argue that even if you think that Islam is the enemy, you still have to be more subtle. And the third option, the one I will advocate, is something more subtle. Not that the enemy is terrorism, not that the enemy is Islam, but that it is, as it were, a terroristic version of Islam, an extremist version, a radical version, a fundamentalist version, totalitarian version, radical utopian version, use what description you will, but it is a certain form of Islam. What is that form? It's a form, first of all, that seeks to apply the Islamic law, the Sharia. The Sharia is somewhat similar to the Halakha. It is somewhat similar to Jewish law, in that both have a lot of statements to make about private life. In Islam, there are precepts about prayers, about cleanliness, about sexuality, dietary restrictions, social relations, child rearing, commercial transactions, criminal penalties, the status of women, minorities, slavery, and much more. But in Islam, unlike Judaism, there is also a second level that has to do with the identity of the ruler, the scope of his rule, the caliphate, the judiciary, taxation, warfare. So radical Islam is about applying the Sharia, the sacred law of Islam, in its entirety. Every aspect of life under the Taliban in Afghanistan, for example, was determined by their reading of the Sharia, and they applied the Sharia to every aspect of life. Secondly, this form of Islam, what I'll call Islamism, is the transformation of faith into a totalitarian ideology. It turns Islam into Islamism. Islamism is like liberalism and socialism and capitalism and communism and fascism. It's an ism. It's a political ideology. It's a body of ideas about structuring society. Muslims of this outlook are a minority, but they are organized, devoted, funded, and they have a purpose, they have a vision, they have an idea of what the world should look like. Islamism, although it has its roots going back to the origins of Islam in the 7th century, is a 20th century phenomenon. It is a modern answer to modern problems. And not coincidentally, it originated in the 1920s. The 1920s were a period in the West when totalitarianism, the idea that the state controls everything, was at its most, had its greatest strength. What with Mussolini in Italy, the rising Nazi power in Germany, Lenin and Stalin in the early years in the Soviet Union, it looked to many people that having the state in charge of everything was the wave of the future. And that expectation reached the Muslim world, where particularly in Egypt and in India, thinkers and activists began to propose this totalitarian form of Islam. The Islamist ideology extends the religion in new directions. For example, 100 years ago, if you'd asked a Muslim about Islamic economics, he'd shrug. There was no such concept. But what the Islamists did is they took the various precepts about the economy and they spun it into a whole system. There is now a substantial body of literature on Islamic economics. It's new. The Islamists see the state as a tool to achieve their goal. It is a radical utopian schema. Islam is the solution, is the one sentence abbreviation of the Islamist ideology. Whatever your question might be, Islam is the solution. It is an Islamic flavor totalitarianism. It resembles fascism and communism more than any other form of religious extremism. It is striking to note that it's not losers, but it's winners in society who staff it. It has been influenced by the brightest minds of the generation. It is a modern phenomenon. It is, thirdly, so first, it's devotion to the sacred law. Second, it's a political ideology. Third, it is a belief in a fundamental difference between the Muslim world and the non-Muslim world. Muslims are superior. Everything Islamic is superior to everything non-Islamic. The world is divided into two parts. Now, of course, there's a need to borrow, particularly in technology and military technology, most of all, medical technology. But there's a hatred and a fear of the outside world, and especially of the United States, or the West, and most especially the United States. There's an intolerance towards all non-Muslims, and a hatred and a fear, and an ambition to dominate. The Islamists are not just content with ruling in, say, Morocco and Malaysia, they want to rule here as well. There is, fourthly, a drive to power, a drive to rule, to control a state, to control the subjects of the state, brutally to force out anyone who disagrees, to expand the power, and ultimately to have global hegemony. That is totalitarian Islam. Now, what's so striking about it is that there are two quite different forms of it. We tend to focus on the violent form, on terrorism in particular, and it is an important form. I don't in any way wish to denigrate its importance, but it is not the only form. There is another form that may be as important or maybe even more important, and that is the non-violent form of Islamism. There are two wings, violent and non-violent. And it is sometimes harder to get people to pay attention to the non-violent form precisely because it doesn't garner headlines. But the non-violent form can be seen at work in the Muslim world and in the West. It is the slow application of the Sharia in society. The application, the segregation, for example, of men and women. The propagation of Islam in school textbooks. The insistence that alcohol and pork products be banned. There was a case just a few days ago in Portland, Maine, where a high school student claimed that because there was a ham sandwich somewhere near him, it was a hate crime. Now, Jews are not particularly fond of ham sandwiches either, but I've never heard of any Jew claiming it was a hate crime to have ham around. But that is an element of pushing, creating an environment, making sure that municipal swimming pools have women and men only hours, banning pork products in the U.S. mail service to go to Iraq, all sorts of things which are small in themselves, but which in the aggregate change society. And while we have this alarmed reaction to terrorism, we tend to not pay attention to these small things. I myself got involved in a case in Minneapolis where the Minneapolis airport was about to have two different cab lights those cabs where the drivers were willing to take passengers with alcohol and those where they weren't. Looked like a pretty good solution from the airport point of view, but I was alarmed because it was the state making a distinction between taxi drivers who follow the Sharia and those who don't. It was the state, the agency of the United States government, that was involved in applying the Sharia. And this is what the Islamists want and are getting, especially in places like Britain and Sweden. So that is what I would suggest to you the nature of the enemy is. It's a form of Islam. Some 10-15% of Muslims are ardent adherents of this. It is not universal. It is not permanent. It has not always been there. But it is today the dynamic form. It is the dominant form. If you were to go to a website, if you were to go to a mosque, if you were to read a weekly newspaper, if you were to go to a store, even in this country, you will bump up against this form of Islam. It is the one that is intellectually, politically, religiously dynamic. It has talented people, has generous funders, it has deep thinkers, it is on the move. It is the vital totalitarian movement of our time after fascism and communism have collapsed, declined. That's the nature of the enemy, I suggest to you. Now, secondly, what do we do about it? This is very fuzzy as well. Former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld in 2001 defined victory in the following way, and I quote, "An environment in which the freedom-loving American people can fulfill and live their freedoms while their enemies are prevented from adversely affecting their way of life." In other words, no more terrorism. I suggest to you that that is not an adequate definition of victory. Just having no more terrorism is not the solution. For one, there are other ways of fighting, and for two, there are ways of not fighting at all, but doing it peaceably. And furthermore, it's not an objective one can hand to a general and say, here, accomplish this. And since 2001, the goals have been vague. I'd like to give you my thoughts on how to achieve victory. And in brief, it is to modernize Islam. And I see this as something that is very demanding, very ambitious. You might think it is unlikely and presumptuous. But totalitarian Islam has been our strategic enemy for some time. That was the message of 9/11. We must, like it or not, influence the Muslim world, as we did Germany and Russia in 1945 and 1991. I think it is useful to look at this as the third major campaign against a totalitarian ideology. In other words, we don't have to begin from scratch. We don't have to invent everything. We can learn from our successes in those two efforts, and more from the Cold War than World War II, because the Cold War was protracted, it was complex, it wasn't just military. It wasn't predominantly military. It had many, many different qualities to it. And so too here. I see two steps. First, we must defeat radical Islam as we defeated the fascists and the communists. Victory is the goal. Victory in the sense that our enemies no longer believe in their vision of the future. Fascism is more or less defunct. Marxist-Leninism is more or less defunct. We must achieve the goal of making Islamism more or less defunct. Still there on the margins, but not what it is today, this dynamic global force. 1945 was an unconditional surrender at the end of a total war, blood and steel, tremendous military campaign. 1991, on the other hand, a subtle intellectual, diplomatic, economic collapse. No fighting. Somewhere between those bookends of total war and no war, or war by proxies, will lie the way to defeat radical Islam. This burden is on us, we in the West, and Americans most especially. The tactics will range from B-2 bombers going out to radio stations. Now, there are many differences between this and the prior two totalitarianisms. For one, there's no great state power. There's no Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia. Iran hardly fits that role. That's to our advantage this time, but there are disadvantages. I would estimate there are 150 million adherents of radical Islam. That's way more than there ever were fascists and communists combined. It's non-Western. It's more difficult to understand. It has a religious base. It's more difficult to fight. But we have the power. We have the demographic power, economic power, military power. If we are unified, if we understand the nature of this problem, and we are unified, nothing can stop us. But if we're divided, as we are today, if many of us don't even think there is a war underway, as I said before, we have all the steel, rubber, and butter that we need. If this looks like a minor phenomenon because there is no great power, this is not like the Nazis or the Soviets with a major military force comparable to ours. If we just shrug it off, then we will be divided. We will argue among ourselves as to the nature of the problem, and we will not be terribly effective. So at the end of the day, the key issue is ourselves. The key battles are here. The key battles are not on the streets of Baghdad or the mountains of Afghanistan. The key battles are here in our perception of the problem. Op-eds and television talking heads and public talks such as this are the key ways in which to fight this war. And for all of us to fight it in our own ways, to make others understand that we are in a major battle, although it is a subtle one. It is a major battle. The key battlefield is that of public opinion, not bullets. So first, we must defeat radical Islam. I'm not going into the details of it. The tactics is a complex topic, just setting out what I see as the goal. We must defeat it as we did successfully to prior totalitarian movements. And second, unlike those past two occasions when we ourselves could offer a solution, particularly in the case of 1945, Germany, Japan, Austria, Italy, we came in with an alternative. We defeated them and we offered them something else which they accepted. These have been quiet, calm, peaceful countries since then. In this case, we can't. We are not a Muslim country. We cannot offer an alternative. It is Muslims themselves who must offer that alternative. My view is that radical Islam is the solution, and moderate Islam is the solution. I'm sorry, radical Islam is the problem, and moderate Islam is the solution. It must be Muslims who offer an alternative to this aggressive, intolerant, violent, totalitarian vision of Islam. It must be Muslims who offer an Islam that is modern, moderate, humane, that respects women and non-Muslims. Therefore, moderate Muslims, Muslims who are against the Islamist project, are critical. One more reason why we can't just throw them into the category of enemy. I would define moderates as those Muslims who want to live a modern life in a modern way, who will want to reinterpret the Quran and other Islamic scriptures in terms of jihad and women and slavery and non-minorities and non-Muslim minorities. They'll reinterpret the role of the Islamic law. Best of all would be no Islamic law, no public Islamic law. It can apply to cleanliness and prayer, but not to taxation and warfare. No slavery, no criminal, no cutting of the hands and so forth. Now, it is often pointed out that moderate Muslims are weak, and indeed they are. There is no movement of moderate Muslims. I mentioned before hundreds of thousands in the streets of Pakistan and Turkey. That's a temporary phenomenon due to a specific problem. It's not a movement. They're not devoting their lives to this enterprise as their opposite numbers are. There is a movement of radical Islam. There are doctors who work in clinics, the financiers who work in banks, they're intellectuals who are developing this program. They're foot soldiers of many sorts. There's no comparable program on the moderate side. They're weak. Islamism has been building since the 1920s. There is no comparable moderate movement. Our role is not to make it happen, but to help it along, to celebrate the moderates, to fund them, to get their ideas out. Such people as politicians and police and the media and the academics should be working with them. Unfortunately, at this time, all those I just read out, politicians, law enforcement, media, academics, tend to work with the Islamists. The Islamists are there, are ready, are organized, are eager, are pretending they are moderates because they're not engaged in terrorism, so they therefore are understood as moderates. But it's not enough. It's not enough to be against terrorism in the abstract. To condemn 9/11, it is necessary to have a truly moderate outlook on life. Now, this approach implies that the problem ultimately is not between the Muslim world and ourselves. It is between one kind of Muslim and another. It is an intra-Muslim problem, not a clash of civilizations. Muslims are arguing among themselves over what it means to be a Muslim. What is the nature of Islam? That argument isn't very vital at this time. Our side, as it were, needs to be stronger. We can help them get stronger. It is Muslims themselves who must come up with an alternative. We can be negative. We can pull down the Islamists, but we can't offer an alternative. That's where the Muslims come in. It also implies that Islamism thrives on success, and that weakness failure will lead to its lowering popularity. And there are plenty of indications of this. 9/11 was a great boost to Islamism. But what I call 11/9, the 9th of November 2001, the fall of the first Afghan city to coalition forces, led to a visible decrease in Islamist popularity. How things turn out, in conclusion, has less to do with the Islamists than it has to do with ourselves. Will we understand this problem for what it is? Will we awaken to see the danger? These are matters that are in our hands. When it comes to yourselves, this means learning the subject matter, being versed in it, being able to converse about it. It means getting active in the political process, supporting those candidates who understand it. It means writing letters to the editor, calling talk shows, participating in internet polemics, joining and donating to those organizations that represent your views, engaging in research. One of the striking things about this is that it's at a local level. You have your Islamists in the North Shore. There is nobody watching them. I invite you to get involved and see who's who and which organization is doing what, and to expose them. There's a lot here to do. There's a lot of work. We're only at the beginning of a very protracted conflict. Each of us has a role in it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Pipes. First question, what effect has the war in Iraq had on either encouraging or discouraging recruits to radical Islam?
The war in Iraq has certainly encouraged recruitment for radical Islam. It has unsettled the Muslim world. It has created a new front. Under Saddam Hussein, a monster, but nonetheless a monster who suppressed this phenomenon. It was contained, With his absence, it has become a greater problem in Iraq and outside Iraq among Muslims who are agitated by developments in Iraq. That's in no way to say that we'd be better off with Saddam Hussein in power. He could well have nuclear weapons by now. But it is to say that, yes, this problem is worse as a result of the new front that Iraq has opened up and the agitation that it has created among Muslims very widely.
As a follow-up question, is then the partial solution in reducing the number of radical Islamists, the U.S., immediately pulling out of Iraq?
No, I don't think that pulling out is a good idea at all, because were we to do that, we would encourage the Islamists. I gave the 9/11/11/9. This would be a new victory for them, and it would encourage them. I also don't think that we're doing the right thing in using U.S. and other coalition forces to serve basically as policemen in securing Iraqi streets. I think that we need to redeploy out of the streets of the cities of Iraq and into the deserts and the border regions. In other words, the troops stay in Iraq, but their mission changes, and Iraqis should take much more control of security. I think the key mistake that was made after the initial victory was to insert American, British, and other troops into the running of Iraq rather than letting Iraqis do that, and that remains a mistake today.
Given the recently released Winograd report, which has been highly critical of much of Israel's senior government and military establishment, what would you see as the best possible scenario for new or revitalized Israeli political leadership?
Israel was, in its early years, an astonishing country by virtue of the quality of its leadership. It's a tiny country, a couple million people. Under pressure, came up with brilliant leadership, political and military. In the last 15 years, Israel has suffered from the most incompetent leadership in any Western country that I can think of. And in part, it has to do with a sense of confidence that it's not under the same pressure. In part, it has to do with changes in society. In part, it has to do with the political system, which is, looking at democracies, it's the least successful. It's a terrible thing. Putting aside authoritarian systems, looking at democratic ones, it's a terrible system. There's probably none worse in the West, in the democratic world, than Israel's. As a result, you have an Israel that has an incompetent leadership. And never has that been more clear than the last year with the prime ministry of Ehud Olmert. And worse than that, there are no prospects for improvement. What we see are retreads. I don't know about you, but I'm not thrilled at the prospect of Benjamin Netanyahu or Ehud Barak coming back to the prime ministry. They failed, both of them, in their last round, and, well, maybe they'll do better. Maybe they're wiser for that experience. Those who have the competence, who could be dynamic leaders, are not going into this. It's a sclerotic system. It's a corrupt system. It's an unpleasant system. It's full of vulgar, coarse, ad hominem attacks, and so not very interesting or attractive individuals end up in it. I mean, look at the way the parties pick their lists. You know, in Israel they pick a list. You don't run as an individual for parliament, you run as part of a list, and you're number one, or you're number 15, or you're number 45. And which you are determines whether you're going to get in or not. One always gets in, and 45 usually does not. And you look at these lists and how they're put together, it's just a sordid picture of corruption. So, Israel has some structural problems. Plus, there is this anti-Zionist quality in its universities, artistic world, and generally among the elite, of seeing Israel as an outdated phenomenon. So between all these factors, it's difficult to see where new blood, new ideas, new institutions are going to come from. Furthermore, as I suggested, the mistakes of the past 15 years have been deep, and I worry that Israel is now going to pay a price for these mistakes, starting with Oslo and ending with the war in Lebanon last summer. The respect for Israel has plummeted in the Muslim world. The deterrence that Israel was able to project 15 years ago is defunct today. 15 years ago, talk about eliminating Israel, or more precisely, eliminating the Jewish state, eliminating Zionism. It's not that they want to get rid of Israel as such. It's a state which is a sovereign Jewish state they want to get rid of. You can keep the name Israel, keep the borders, but have it be dominated by Palestinians or Muslims or Arabs, and it's okay. So it's the Jewish nature of the state that's anathema. And the idea of ending that, eliminating that 15 years ago, was defunct. Nobody really felt that that was something they could achieve. Today it is alive. It's alive with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in Iran. It's alive with commentators in Western publications. It's alive in the United Nations. It's alive in endless university courses. The existence of Israel is now in question in a way that it simply was not. And this is something the Israelis have, in part, not completely, brought on themselves by their incompetent leadership. I don't know what the answer is, short of a restructuring, short of a shock, short of awakening to the problems they're in. And what's so striking is that the Israelis tried Oslo, tried bargaining, and that failed. Everybody agrees that failed. And then they tried unilateralism, leaving Lebanon in 2000, leaving Gaza in 2005. That's widely seen to have failed. And now there's no real answer. My answer is go back to deterrence. Go back to what you did between 1948 and 1993. For 45 years, the Israelis very effectively sent a signal to their enemies, don't you dare. If you do this, you'll pay heavily for it. And while it didn't completely succeed, between 1948 and 1993, Israel's stature and strength increased enormously. It didn't quite finish. It wasn't all over in 1993, but it was going in the right direction very nicely. And then the Israelis got impatient. Didn't want to do deterrence anymore. Deterrence is a long-term, boring, expensive, passive doctrine. And yet, it is the one that worked. And I hope they go back to that, because unilateralism and negotiations are not what are working. Deterrence did work, and I believe would work again. So it's hard to be optimistic. It is flourishing in some ways, economically and culturally, but in terms of the relationship with the enemies of Israel, things are much worse than they were in prior years.
Given the attacks in the recent past in Europe, particularly in Spain and in England, and the simultaneous growth of the Muslim population in Europe, where do you see Europe heading in the next 10 years?
Oh, thank you. One of my favorite topics. I think there are three options for Europe and its Muslim population. The first is that they work it out. Muslims are assimilated, integrated, get good jobs, and there's no problem. Fortunately, I don't see the sources of that happy outcome. I think there are two other alternatives which are more likely. I can't tell you which one will happen. I can tell you that they're both very unpleasant for the Europeans and for us. One is that the developments of the past four decades continue, in that the Muslim population grows larger, more assertive, more demanding, and the Europeans essentially acquiesce to it. And what you find at the end of the road is what some people call Eurabia, namely a Muslim-dominated Europe, a Europe that is akin to North Africa. Of course, there are non-Muslims there in substantial numbers, but there's a Muslim domination, if not exactly 51%, in many, many other ways. Politically, religiously, culturally, one sees a Europe that is more Islamic than anything else. And one then can imagine the implications, you know, Notre Dame turning into a museum and then one day blown up. You know, you can see what's happened elsewhere in the world when Muslims have come to dominate and taken over mosques, taken over churches and turned them into mosques and so forth. But there's an alternative, and some, quite a few analysts of Europe are predicting this. Oriana Fallaci, for example, Mark Stain, and others. That's certainly a possibility, but I think there's an alternative that's no less likely. And that is that the Europeans at a certain point say, no, we don't like this process. We don't like this Islamification of Europe. And we are, at this point in 2007, 95% of the population, or in some years, 90%, 85%, but still the overwhelming majority of the population, we say no. We want to stand by our civilization, our faith, our traditional ways, and you must fit into it. And if you don't fit into it, out. And we can see the fascist elements wanting to push out or kill Muslims. One can see that. One can also see Muslims rejecting this and saying no. The riots of a year and a half ago in Paris could be a foretaste of the kind of violence that was not very violent, just cars were destroyed, only a few deaths. But one can imagine it being far more violent and more protracted. One can imagine in many parts of Europe that Muslim areas become armed camps, the police don't go there, military avoid it, forays out. You already read, for example, in Malmö in southern Sweden about Muslims leaving the Muslim area and going out and just randomly attacking ethnic Swedes, in part for the booty they get from it, but in part to assert who they are. And other Swedes just watch and don't dare take part. One can see that kind of violence. In short, I think that there's a possibility that the last, or even probability, that the last six decades of Pax Americana, of a quiet, peaceable Europe, is the exception. That's not the way Europe has been historically, and it's not the way Europe is going to be in the future. And we will be very much influenced by either Arabia or protracted conflict in the continent. We will be harmed by that. This is a huge topic. And it's one that tends to be ignored because there's a focus on the mundane aspects of, you know, the price of a euro or unemployment rates and so forth. And while those have their importance, this is something that is quietly of extraordinary significance. It's the elephant in the room. It tends not to be discussed by Europeans. It tends to be we from the outside who are focused on it. Europeans are generally not willing to talk about it. That's perhaps going to change, perhaps not. We'll see. But I don't know that we can, I certainly can't predict at this point which way Europe is going. I can just say it doesn't look good.
This next question I'd like to turn around a little bit. It starts by asking, can the Saudis and other moderate Arab nations play a positive role for peace? Before we get to your answer on that, let me ask first this question. Do you agree that the Saudis are a moderate Arab nation?
Well, the Saudis are moderate in the State Department lexicon because the government of Saudi Arabia is one we can work with. It's not like, say, the Syrian one. It is, we've consultations and we have all sorts of cooperative agreements with them on every level, and so it's moderate in that sense. But your laughter is justified. Saudi Arabia is not moderate. Let me go back to a distinction I made before. There are two forms of Islamicization, of forwarding the Islamist program. One is violent, and one is nonviolent. The violent one would be epitomized by Osama bin Laden. The nonviolent one would be epitomized by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, a name you may not know, but he's the Prime Minister of Turkey. And he may be in a position, and these days are very, 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 very important, to change Turkey from a secular country into an Islamic state. country of 75 million people. He's doing it completely legally, working as a politician, as prime minister of a major party, changing things bit by bit. So our view since 1992 has been that Islamists who use violence are a problem, we'll fight them. But Islamists who don't use violence are fine. We have our differences with Erdogan of Turkey, but he's perfectly legitimate, perfectly fine. And if you look at the media in the last week on the Turkish crisis, everybody says he's just fine. I say he's not. I say he is no less of a problem than bin Laden. Bin Laden uses violence, Erdogan does not, but Erdogan also wants to build an order that is Islamist, that is totalitarian. He'll get at it in a more gentle way. He will kill fewer people. But ultimate goal is the same order. Now, applied to Saudi Arabia, the Saudis have pushed for decades and decades a soft form, a nonviolent form of Islamization. The Wahhabi doctrines are very powerful around the world, thanks to huge amounts of money and creativity and drive on the part of the Saudis. Whether it be American prisons or school textbooks or national Muslim organizations or mosques, whether it be in Somalia or in Bosnia or in Indonesia, you see the Saudis pushing their form of Islamism. But it's not a violent form. They're not interested in terrorism. They understand that the long-term success is by changing people's minds and through schools and mosques and books and cassettes and CDs and whatnot. They are doing that with great success. However, there's another strain in Saudi Arabia that is violent. That is a strain one might identify with bin Laden or the Taliban, or those who are using violence within Saudi Arabia itself. As recently as last week, a major terrorist operation was disrupted that would have done great damage to the oil facilities and other important buildings in Saudi Arabia. They hate that. So they're with us in fighting the violent form of radical Islam. They didn't sponsor, the government didn't sponsor 9/11. It was the more radical interpretation, the Taliban interpretation, you might call it, not the monarchical interpretation. They're with us on that, but they're against us in that they support this this nonviolent form of Islamification. Turning to the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Saudis have historically been minor players. They historically have not had a leading diplomatic or military role in the conflict. That has changed. Militarily, they're developing a real significant force with ballistic missiles and long-range planes and so forth. Diplomatically, since 2002, they have become active. The Abdullah Plan of 2002 and other diplomatic initiatives, the Mecca Agreement of February of this year, and they are throwing their weight around a bit. I don't see that they in any way accept the continued existence of a Jewish state. They don't necessarily want to see it destroyed through airplane attacks or nuclear missiles. They do want to see it transformed. That is their way. They're not violent. They seek its transformation in more gentle ways. So the Abdullah Plan is notable for the fact that it offers Israel resolution of the conflict in return for the right of return. The right of return is code word for Arabs swamping Israel demographically. That's a nice way of solving the Israel problem, isn't it? You just have millions and millions of people claim to be Palestinians and move in. And if it's a democratic country, no more Zionism. The Jews become a minority in the country. So what's so striking about the Arab-Israeli conflict is how many different approaches there are, how many different ideologies there are. In the early part of the 20th century, the dominant ideology was pan-Syrian, the idea that what is the area that Israel comprises was part of a Syrian nation. And then came the pan-Arab ideology, that that area is part of a Arab nation that goes from Morocco to Iraq. And then came Palestinianism, the idea that there's a Palestine that that's instead of Israel. And finally today, in the last year or two, you see Islamism as the dominant force. But what's so striking is that there have been four different ideologies: Pan-Syrianism, Pan-Arabism, Palestinianism, Islamism. But the conflict remains roughly the same. It's always an attempt to undo the Zionist achievement, or to prevent it in the early years. And that remains constant. And Israel was, I suggested earlier, far more advanced in its effort to undo that ambition in, say, 1992 or 3 than it is today. Has gone backwards in the last 15 years. And the Saudis jumping into the fray diplomatically and militarily is not good news, no. Not a constructive force.
This next question is a follow-up and perhaps sharpens the focus in a more pragmatic way to the last question in your answer. The question is, the downfall of Soviet communism took 80 years. Can Israel and Jews around the world survive the gradual evolution of radical Islam that you said is temporary in nature until such time as they're no longer an active threat?
It is a threat to Jews globally, to the Jews of Israel via the weapons of mass destruction, both in Iran and potentially elsewhere, such as Syria. It is a threat to the Jews of Europe. I can well imagine European Jewry shriveling as Middle Eastern Jewry shriveled. It was 1 million people in the late 1940s. It's now 60,000 outside of Israel. One can imagine roughly that same proportion in Europe. French Jewry going from 500,000 to 20,000, as happened, say, in Morocco or Iraq. The threat is least here, but one can imagine that developments in Europe will also be here. So it is a threat everywhere. And whether Jews will survive it or not is not a question I can answer, but I do think Jews have a history of surviving such threats, not always coming through entirely intact from the experience, but it is a time of tribulation. I mean, it's been easy since 1945. It's getting ever more difficult.
You told us during your presentation, mentioned certain Israeli leaders that are likely hanging in the wings that may come to power if the current government falls, and you gave us a hint of the relative unpopularity in your view. Let me ask the flip side of that. Are there Israeli leaders currently on the scene that in your view could assume effective leadership in Israel?
Well, effective leadership can pertain to lots of issues. Let me just focus on the key issue for them and for me, which is relationship with the enemies of Israel, dealing with the enemies of Israel. I see not a single politician, now in Parliament who understands that Israel is at war and needs to win the war. I don't know every last one of 120 members of Parliament, but let's talk about the leaders of their parties, if not every single one. Not a single Israeli active politician in government or in Parliament understands this basic fact that Israel is at war, and at war you either win or you lose, and Israel's goals, as I understand it, are to get its neighbors, enemies, to accept its existence as a Jewish state. And the enemy's goal is to eradicate that Jewish nature of the Israeli state. It's clear, it's binary, it's crude, it's raw, it's unchanged. This is the way it was in 1948. And yet, I mean, let me give you an example of Moshe Yaalon, the former chief of staff of the Israeli military, of the IDF. I'm not sure if he's in the parliament or not. I don't think he is. But anyway, he's a significant figure. He's a brilliant figure, and he speaks well, and he analyzes it beautifully. But at the end of his analysis, he concludes that Israel needs to find some deal with the Palestinians, which to me suggests he doesn't understand the conflict that Israel's in. They are in a conflict that will not be resolved through mediation, through negotiations, through compromise. To put it slightly differently, Yitzhak Rabin, 15 years ago, when he came to office in 1992, said, "You don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies." That became his mantra. You make peace with your enemies. And I think in that simple statement lies the essence of the Israeli mistake. I would reply, you do not make peace with your enemies. You make peace with your former enemies, with people who no longer are your enemies, who've given up. Only at that point can you have negotiations and compromise and so forth that will work. But if you're talking to enemies, they still harbor the goal of destroying you. And that's precisely what the Israelis have done, is they've given benefits, land and money, and recognition to, for example, the PLO, which remains its enemy, which won't even go, doesn't even have the good grace to change its charter and pretend that it's not an enemy. It's still got the same damn charter. And so that is the essence of the Israeli mistake, is to think that they could reach an agreement. The Israelis, who are fed up with this problem and want out and want to live a normal life, and fully understandably, who have a dynamic economy and modern life, have this atavistic conflict going on. They want out. And so what they're saying basically, look, we'll give you something. We'll give you what you want. What do you really want? We'll give it to you. Now leave us alone. Unfortunately, it doesn't work, not with ideological enemies. There's a name for that policy, by the way. It's called appeasement. Give you what you want, now leave us alone. It doesn't work. And yet that has been the heart of the Israeli approach in the 1990s, and in the 2000s, it's been, we'll just put up a wall, we'll leave Lebanon, we'll leave Gaza, we'll just, you know, disengage from you, and you know, you're there and we're here. That doesn't work either. If you have an enemy, your enemy will continue to attack you. If you leave Gaza, you'll find yourself getting at the receiving end of Qassam missiles and perhaps more powerful missiles to come. If you do the same in the West Bank, you'll get it. I mean, it was interesting to note last summer that the missiles were coming from Gaza and from Lebanon, and they were not coming from the West Bank. And guess why? The Israelis were still there. So, no, I see no politician. There were, I mean, one example would be Uzi Landau, who made a bid for the leadership of the Likud party and lost to Benjamin Netanyahu and was given a low ranking. Remember about the rankings? Given a low ranking, so he's not in parliament anymore. And the few individuals who do understand this problem have left politics, are in business, because they have no future in politics. I'm worried. I'm pessimistic on this. I just don't see where the rejuvenation is going to come from, short of some terrible incident, some terrible development that will shake everyone up. But on its own, I just don't see it happening. And if you look at the turmoil that's going on now, these are not the issues that are raised. The Secretary of State has started a negotiating process that everyone knows at this point is futile, if not counterproductive, and yet everybody's participating in it.
Follow up to the last answer. The public perception in the United States, at least, is that Benjamin Netanyahu, whatever his failings might be, does not fail to understand that giving land for nothing is not an agreeable solution for Israel. Given that, why is it your opinion that Netanyahu is not a desirable leader for Israel in the near term?
Before answering, I want to tell you that I really am a fairly cheerful person. It's just my... It's just my topic. It's my topic. It's not me. If I were analyzing something else, I'd be, you know, full of optimism. It's not my fault that I got this topic. Anyway, back to Benjamin Netanyahu. I've known him since, or slightly known him, since 1982 when we were both in Washington at low levels. I was delighted when he became prime minister in 1996. I had great hopes for him. But by the time he left office in 1999, I was deeply disappointed. You say that he, or you're quoting the questioner, saying that he understands that you don't give up land for nothing. Well, but I'll give you an example of the contrary, which is somewhat forgotten. He was in office from 96 to 99. I believe the dates were 97, 98. There was a serious negotiation between Israel and Syria, conducted, among others, by Ronald Lauder, going back and forth, shuttle diplomacy. And it had to do, with the Golan Heights and recognition of Israel and so forth. And to make a long story short, Netanyahu was willing to give up quite a bit more than Rabin or Peres were in order to have a breakthrough. In other words, how do you get yourself reelected as prime minister? What striking thing can you do? You can have a new peace accord with an Arab state. This is what Netanyahu wanted. And it was Sharon, who was defense minister at the time, who nixed it. And it didn't go forward. But Netanyahu was willing to give up the Golan Heights for paltry returns and to do it on really poor terms. He, in fact, did give up a slice of Hebron for nothing, but I think the Golan Heights, aborted Golan Heights offer was the more significant. The profound point I would make about Netanyahu is that, at least last time, is that he had no philosophy, he had no guidelines, he had no deep beliefs. He spun around with whatever the political process required him. He had no grounding and therefore was unreliable. He would do what he thought was popular. At the time, I called him the Israeli version of Bill Clinton. But he was worse than Clinton, in that he really had no grounding. And from what I can tell, that hasn't changed. And so I worry that it'll be another ride on the roller coaster with someone who doesn't really have a position. Someone who promises one thing, which he did in 1996, and in fact does something quite different. And so I don't hold out hopes that it would be different a second time around.
Maybe two more. This next question perhaps challenges your assertion of your cheerful nature and disposition by asking, shifting focus to the near term American political election. Is your view any more sanguine with regard to any of the major Democratic or Republican candidates in terms of his or her understanding of radical Islam and what to do about their involvement in Iraq?
Well, there's a profound difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Republicans talk incessantly about this topic. Romney has given a major speech and minor ones. Giuliani, of course, this is who he is. It's why he is a presidential candidate. McCain is someone who talks about victory. The Democrats, if one just takes the top three on either side, the Democrats are conspicuous by not talking about it. Obama is the only one to have made any statement, one brief statement that I could find, and Clinton and Edwards have simply not spoken at all. So there is a real big difference between the two parties in this area.
It seems that the educational systems in many Arab countries have been entrusted or has been or have been entrusted to the Islamists. This seems to indicate the growth of radical thinking. How can this be combated so as to encourage more moderate thinking?
Islamists have taken over the educational systems, yes, to a certain extent they have. The ultimate answer to that would be less throwing them out, which would be nice, but really the ultimate answer is to make the whole project uninteresting. Look, the Soviet children were taught decade after decade about the beauties and the eternal verities of Marxist-Leninism. Rather quickly, they became disaffected. And by the end, no one believed that rubbish. It was taught rotely and routinely, but no one really believed it anymore. In a faster way, one sees something like that in Iran. The Iranian Republic is not even 30 years old. The Islamic Republic of Iran is not even 30 years old, and yet you find an alienation in Iran from these teachings that is somewhat comparable to, say, Brezhnevite Soviet Union. Now, the Iranians went through the ringer. They had the full experience of Islamism. They lived under it now for a full generation. The challenge is to figure out some way to convey to Muslims the dangers and the oppression and the miseries of totalitarian Islam without having them have to live under it. Algerians have learned a similar lesson. They went through a miserable civil war that led to the deaths of 100 to 200,000 Algerians. Many Algerians have learned the lesson. Is there some way to convey to Muslims the dangers that this involves? I don't know. I worry that it's necessary for them, one by one, to go through this and see and learn that this is not the way to live, that this is not the way to the good life, this is not the way to peace and prosperity, this is not the way to strength, this is not the way to live as a good Muslim even. If you want to live as a good Muslim, you don't want your government telling you what to do. So the attractions of Islamism are considerable, and they attract across the board, male and female, educated and not, young and old, convert and born, majority population, minority population, you name it. You find recruits from all different sources, all different characteristics. And the challenge is, how do we speed up this process? So the damage wrought by this ideology is not so great. Now, I mean, so far it's tiny. If you look at fascism and communism as the standard, how many tens of millions? I mean, within China alone, the estimate is 40 million dead. Just internal Chinese matters. What is it, 60 million dead in the Second World War? I mean, these are huge, horrific numbers. What are the numbers for radical Islam? Well, the largest number of dead would be the, I don't know, a couple million in Sudan. That's maybe too high a number, but a very significant number in Sudan. I said 150,000, let's say, in Morocco, in Algeria. 20,000 in Syria. 3,000 in the United States, some hundreds or thousands or two in, let's say 2,000 in Israel, and so forth. I think the estimate is 15,000 in Nigeria. These are not negligible numbers, but they are very tiny compared to the numbers in the prior two. Is there some way to avoid these horrific numbers? Is there some way to keep this down in the hundreds and the thousands rather than the tens of millions? These are the kinds of challenges we face. And yet, because of the war in Iraq, because we're not feeling like we're in a regular war, it is easy to forget this. It is easy to have a September 10th mentality. It is easy to not see this as the threat that it really is. I thank you for your interest and your attention.